The first one was in 1913. It was a bicycle wheel.
Just an ordinary wheel?
An ordinary wheel, bicycle wheel, on a stand. I would turn it as I passed by. The movement of it would be like a fire in a fireplace. You know, it has that attraction of something moving in the room while you think about something else. Then the second one was a bottle dryer. You know, they have in cellars, in the French cellars, you put the bottles up.
The wine bottles.
The wine bottles. When they're empty, you put them on. And
after they've been washed.
Yes. And then the third one was a snow shovel, which I did here in New York when I first came in 1915. It was just a plain snow shovel, bought it in a hardware shop. Mm-hmm. And it's now, one of the replica of it is in Yale. Another one was called Why Not Sneeze? Of course, the title is not a descriptive title, because that ready-made was made of a birdcage, a small birdcage, in which, instead of a bird, there were cubes, which looked like sugar cubes.
The cubes are white marble.
That was the pun, the visual pun, that you, when you picked it up, you understood it was marble and no more on sugar.
Yes.
I also added a thermometer in it. Another one was the vial. I was in Paris in 1919, and I was thinking of bringing back a present for Arnsberg in California. So I went to a drugstore and said, will you give me a vial that you'll empty of whatever serum is in it and seal it again, and what it'll be in it will be Paris, air of Paris. Of course it had to be. So the druggist did it, and I brought my present to Arnsberg, to California, and it was called a vial with 50 cubic centimeters of air of Paris.
Was that the last of the actual ready-mades to be manufactured?
Yes, but in my notes in the green box, I mentioned some that could be made. One is, I call it a reciprocal ready-made. You take a painting by Rembrandt, and instead of looking at it, you use it plainly as an ironing board. You iron your clothes on it, so it becomes a ready-made and reciprocal.
It's rather hard on the Rembrandt.
It is. But we had to be iconoclastic then.
Mr. Duchamp, there then are two kinds of ready-mades. Those which exist, so to speak, already before you came upon them, mm-hmm. and those which you have assisted. Do you put any priority on one kind rather than the other?
No, it was sort of to add a little diversity to the idea. It was not a very active part of my life, except when you make one or two ready-mades a year, you have plenty of time for something else.
Mm-hmm. Do you think anybody else could make one?
Yes, everybody can, but as I don't attach any value, I mean commercial value or even artistic value to it, hardly anybody would do it for the sake of doing it.
Is there any way in which we can think of a ready-made as a work of art?
That is the very difficult point, because art first has to be defined. All right. Can we try to define art? We have tried. Everybody has tried. And every century there's a new definition of art, meaning that there's no essential, and one essential that is good for all centuries. So if we accept the idea of trying not to define art, which is a very legitimate conception, then the ready-made comes in as a sort of irony, because it says, here it is, a thing that I call art. I didn't even make it myself. As we know, art, etymologically speaking, means to make, handmake. And there, instead of making it, I take it ready-made. So it was a form of denying the possibility of defining art. And because you don't define electricity, you just see the results of electricity, but you don't define it.
But with the ready-mades, it seems to me that they carry out of the world of everyday life out of the hardware shop,
mm-hmm.
as in the case of the snow shovel, something of your own sense of irony and wit. And therefore, can't we believe that they have some sort of
message?
Not message, no, but value, which is artistic, even though you haven't made them, yet your intention in setting them aside from everything else,
yes.
in the world, does not that give them some kind of possibly intellectual value? Which
it has. It has a conceptual value, if you want to say conceptual. I don't know whether it means exactly what we want to say. It has, but it takes away all the technical jargon of painting. Painting should be made with colors. Painting should be made with a pencil, with brushes. And when you take something that is not made by those technical instruments, then you don't know where you are. You don't know whether you should take it as a work of art, and that's where the irony comes in.
The irony, of course, is very much part of the Dada spirit, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. That was a very important form of introducing humor in a very serious world at the time, First World War.
You said once to me some years ago that the Dada spirit had been operating, so to speak, in New York with you, for instance, and Man Ray, before Dada was named as a movement.
Oh, yes, yes. It was in the air, as many of these things are. And we certainly had the same spirit as in Zurich when Zara and Arp and Ilsenbeck started under the name of Dada. They found the name. Of course, the name was a good sort of flag around which all these ideas expressed.
The slogan.
Yeah, the slogan. And that helped the movement a lot. And of course, the Dada spirit has always existed, exists today. A man like Rabelais, he certainly is a Dada in essence. So is Jarry, a great man, and we could find any number of them in the past centuries.
Would you consider that Dada is more than just a criticism of art? Is it also a criticism of society?
It is completely much more. It's been the nonconformist spirit which has existed in every century, every period since Man is Man.
Another work, which is the large glass, the
yes.
wide strip there by her own bachelors in the English translation?
Yes.
Which is now in the Philadelphia Museum.
It was started in 1913-14. I worked on it before the war, and even though I tried in that big glass to find a completely personal and new expression, the final product was to be a wedding of mental and visual reactions. In other words, the ideas in the glass are more important than the actual visual realization.
But this sounds almost contradictory, because a work of art is primarily a visual experience.
Yes, but this welding of two different sources of inspiration gave me a satisfactory answer to in my research for something that had not been previously attempted. Being the young man who wants to do something by himself and not copy the others, not use too much of the tradition, my research was in that direction, to find some way of expressing myself without being a painter, without being a writer, without taking one of these labels, and yet producing something that would be an inner product of myself. The two things, mixing up the ideas and their visual representation, attracted me as a technique, if it has to be a technique after all. And this hybrid form explains why I didn't have anyone to agree with me more or less, or to follow my ways of looking at it.
You had to invent everything for the first time.
Yes, because since Courbet, as you know, the revolution of Courbet was mainly a visual revolution, what you call a Retinian revolution. He insisted, or he insisted without even mentioning it, on that a painting is to be looked at and only looked at, and the reaction should be visual or retinal, plain physical reaction in front of a painting. And this has been going on since Courbet. It's still in vogue, if I might say, today. If you speak to a painter today, he will never think of an anecdote of a It's all the line, the form, the play of the colors together, and the more abstract, the better.
Mm-hmm. And all of that has nothing to do with the glass.
I thought it was a reaction against the original conception of painting, and I think it does, it still has. Because of the introduction of the conceptual, not entirely literary, because you might call it, well, this is literary painting, it's been done before, of course, but it's much deeper than literary. It's using words, but then everything that uses words is not necessarily literary, as you know.
No. Are there any ready-made elements in the glass?
Hardly, no. No, there's hardly any ready-made. It was two different departments in my activities at the time.
At this point, the interview in Duchamp's New York flat breaks off. When the tape arrived in London, Charles Mitchell and I, together with George Heard Hamilton, who had meanwhile come to England, listened to it, and our comments were recorded. Then, in September, Marcel Duchamp himself came to London and heard these remarks. I was with him in the BBC studio on that occasion, and we then talked further. Charles Mitchell, whose voice comes next, is answered by Duchamp.
He seems to have all the marks of being in the classic French tradition. He's one of the most classic of French artists. That's why he's utterly un-Dada. There's nothing really Dada about Duchamp at all, I don't think. I think the sort of things that he did as a result of his classical thinking, exactly what the position of composition is, and how much beauty comes in, whether you do it, whether beauty is ideal, whether beauty is a thing given by chance. All that sort of thinking, which I get the impression that he did very deliberately and sensitively. He's exactly like the Poussin of 20th century French art. He's the most intellectual of the cubists that there was.
I'm not at all in accord with this business of making me a classic of French painting. In the first place, because of my resistance to be an artist, as artists are made of today, and the word artist also is a conception that I tried to get out of in the first place.
But you do perhaps find it a little gratifying to be thought of among such exalted company.
Well, it's always pleasant to receive compliments, but that's not the point here. I really have no thought about that very much. I don't care whether I am or not. What I am, in fact, I don't care. I doubt the word to be.
And do you also approve of Charles Mitchell's attempt to dissociate you from Dada?
Dada, less, because as we said before, Dada is a spirit. It's not only a movement of 1916, 17, 18. It has always existed since Adam and Eve. So if I'm not a Dada in the 1916 sense, I at least have something in common with the attitude of a Rabelais, of a Jarry, in my way of looking at life.
The Zurich Dada is behaved in a very elaborate, farcical way. It's burlesque. What is humour and wit and irony in Duchamp becomes burlesque and farce in the Dada people. And although there is a tinge of this burlesque in Duchamp, he keeps it very clear of his work. It comes out in photographs, odd photographs taken of him by various people when he's got his hair covered in shampoo and snooks are brought up with his hair in points all over his head. These things, I do see, are like Dada, but in a way it's in Duchamp's social life, which is reflected in this way. It has nothing to do with his work. The in Duchamp is always in a very clearly defined structure that he's building up. In a note in the box somewhere, he talks about the green box and the picture are things that could occur. They are real in a way, but they're only real if one extends the laws of physics and chemistry and mathematics. You have to stretch the real world slightly. I think he uses, or at least the word has been translated as distending. Now this distending of the real world is done by Duchamp in a very meticulous way. He doesn't float out into the dream world ever. It's always a world of precision, a world which he has made himself on a very firm basis of understanding of the real laws of chemistry and physics and mathematics, but he is prepared to push them a little bit further, to give them an edge of unreality, but only by relating it to the real world in a very precise way. And that's something that I think that Surrealists and the Dadaists were incapable of doing. It was always an attempt to get into the subconscious mind. One thing that he says in the general notes again is this: always, or nearly always, give reasons for the choice between two or more solutions by ironical causality.
Yes.
Ironical causality is one of the techniques by which he makes decisions. But it is always a very prim, conceptual decision that he makes.
Yes, but this can be a joke at the same time.
It is a joke, and it's phrased as a joke.
Yes, it is a joke, all right. But it's based on the fact that I have my doubts about real causality. There's no real reason for using causality. Why not use it ironically by inventing a world in which things come out differently from the usual one? We can imagine a new causality in which you invent your own reasons for this or that. Don't you think so?
Do you see a distinction between your own activity, which is a world invented by you, and the activity of the Surrealist proper, people like Dali, who tried to work without any conscious effort? One might suppose that your juxtaposition of something which you call a chocolate machine, combined in the same picture with something which you call a cemetery of uniforms and liveries,
yes,
is a Surrealist activity. But these ideas of yours are always closely related into a system. They're not arbitrary juxtapositions, mm-hmm, fully. You always seek justification,
yeah,
for your act. The Surrealists stressed the fact that these juxtapositions were unjustified.
Yes, I do. It's not entirely fantasy. The subconscious really never interested me very much as a basis for an art expression of any kind. It's true that I really was very much of a Cartesian, if you could use the word défroqué, which means unfrocked Cartesian, because I was very pleased by the so-called pleasure of using Cartesianism as a form of thinking, logic, and very close mathematical thinking. But yet I was also very pleased by the idea of getting away from it. It happened also in several plays of Roussel, a writer who wrote these completely fantastic descriptions of the same order, where everything can be done, especially when you describe it in words, anything can be invented. And in Locus Solus and in Impression d'Afrique, that's where really I found the source of my new activity in 1911 or 12.
In spite of the fact that one thinks of you as sitting right on top of Cubism, you felt a need after just one or two years of experience of Cubism that you wanted to find a new path for yourself. And I take it that this is the way in which you found it, by an exploration of intellectual and conceptual terms,
yes,
juxtaposed to the physical configurations that you made.
Yes, I very soon got impatient, so to speak, with Cubism, at least impatient in that way that I couldn't see any future for me in it. In fact, I've touched Cubism rather little. The new Descendants of Caircase is inspired by Cubism, naturally. But the addition of movement in it, which seems to be futuristic, and is futuristic, but futuristic only because the futurists had spoken of movement, were speaking of movement at the time, that doesn't make it a new idea of theirs. Movement was in the air. There was something more important than the futurists for me in that case. It was the publication of fencing or horse galloping and so forth, photos, you know,
photographed by Muybridge.
Yes, and that gave me the real idea for the nude. And it's only later, months later, that I saw the Bala, the futurist Bala with his dog and 20 legs. And even there, there was only Bala and I who had the idea of multiplying the legs. But Shuni was entirely different. He really used planes more than lines. In other words, even today you can compare them and see there is no direct influence from painter to painter, especially that I never knew them. I never knew Shuni and met him in the end of January 1912. And I never had any real relationship with them at all. So movement took me out of Cubism, if I may say. Up to then, I wasn't sure. I did the King and the Queen after that, and it was the end of Cubism for me, end of 12. And already some other ideas came, and how to get out of Cubism, and I found it in the chocolate grinder, which was completely static then, although it might move if you let it move, but it was completely a reversal of forgetting about movement, forgetting about cubism, and finding some new way for my expression. And the source of it, as I say, was Roussel, who gave me the idea of inventing new men, so to speak, new beings, whether made of metal or of flesh. The bride is a sort of mechanical bride, if you want to say. It's not the bride itself, it's a concept of a bride that I had to put on the canvas one way or another, but it was more important that I should have thought of it in words, in terms of words, before I actually drew it. What a glass does represent is not a copy of a bride in her best clothes or otherwise, yet there are parts that are called the bride, and the other part of the glass, which is called the bachelors. In other words, you can see the bachelors in a sort of not abstract form, but at least not detailed forms or not natural form. The same with the bride is an invention of a bride, of my own, a new human being, half a robot and half fourth dimensional. The idea of the fourth dimension also was very important in that period. Anything that has a three-dimensional form is the projection in our world from a fourth-dimensional world. And my bride, for example, would be a three-dimensional projection of a fourth-dimensional bride. All right, then since it's on the glass, it's flat, so my bride is a two-dimensional representation of a three-dimensional bride who also would be a fourth-dimensional projection on the three-dimensional world of the bride.
As you have gathered, the large glass has many layers of meaning, both conceptual and philosophical. It also uses many layers of symbols, primitive or sophisticated, but irony is always present.
Yes, it is an ironical. It really probably took birth in my mind from the fairs, you know, country fairs in France at least, where they have the wedding scene. And you have big balls that you throw at the heads of the bride, of the bridegroom and the guests. But they have disappeared now, but there used to be in every country fair a little stand, and the great joy of the children was to throw big, and then of course the bride would fall out when touched the right place, and she was in white and the bridegroom in black, and it must have been that kind. You see, the country fair is a milieu for the painters since Seurat. That's an influence that I can admit in that case, where I was probably tempted to use, and I did.
All through the glass, you use fairly clear-cut symbology, a very direct kind. Man and woman are identified as the and the operations of these, the functions of the machinery, are all explainable in sexual terms. It is this sexual relationship which is the basic preoccupation of the graph.
Yes. Eroticism is a very dear subject to my in my life, and I certainly applied that liking or that love to my glass, and in fact I thought it was only an excuse for doing anything, is to give it the life of eroticism, which is completely close to life in general, and more than philosophy or anything like that. And it's an animal thing that has so many facets that it's pleasing to use it as a tube of paint, so to speak, to inject in your productions. It's there, stripped bare. I mean, it's a form of fantasy. It's a little to do also with stripped bare, probably had even a naughty connotation with the Christ, You know, the Christ was stripped bare. And it was a naughty form of introducing eroticism and religion. I'm ashamed of what I'm saying.
There has often been an element of the sacrilegious in Duchamp. The gesture of painting a moustache and beard on the Mona Lisa seemed all the more blasphemous in not being executed by a Philistine. George Hamilton, Charles Mitchell and I discussed this.
But the Mona Lisa's moustache strikes me as being not an attack upon the Mona Lisa, it's an attack upon the manipulation of false values by tourists, by museum officials, by...
It's exactly like Hogarth. They think because I hate them, I hate Titian.
Yes.
He used to guy them in just the same way.
Well, what he values in the art of the past are its concepts, not its residue, not its leaving.
Doesn't he like the actual works of art?
I feel not. And how do you feel about the works of art of the past, their deification in museums?
I have a very definite theory, call it theory, so that I can be wrong, that a work of art exists only when the spectator has looked at it. Until then, it's only something has been done but might disappear and nobody would know about it. But the spectator consecrates it by saying, this is good, we'll keep it. And the spectator in that case becomes posterity. And posterity keeps the museums full of paintings, don't they, today? My impression is that these museums, called the Prado, called the National Gallery, called the Louvre, are only receptacles of things that have survived. Probably mediocrities, because they happen to have survived. There's no reason to make them so important and big and beautiful, and there's no justification for that label of beautiful. They have survived. Why have they survived? It's not because they are beautiful. It's because they have survived by the law of chance. We probably have lost many, many other artists of those same periods who were as beautiful or even more beautiful.
And how do you feel about the consecration of your own works in museums?
The same way. I'm not concerned because I don't consider myself any different from the others. And I think my real feeling is that a work of art is only a work of art for a very short period.